Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today's show will have two segments. In the first segment, two guests who helped make Iceland number one in the world for gender equality will share their experience and discuss how we might learn from their experience to improve conditions for women, men, and families. Guest is the new mayor of Alexandria, Alison Silberberg, a lifelong advocate for social justice, and author of the inspiring book, Visionaries in Our Midst, Ordinary People Who Are Changing Our World. We'll discuss how she took on a pro-development incumbent and won, and what she will do as mayor. First up are two women who are leaders in making Iceland number one in the world for gender equality. Katrín Anna Gudmundsdóttir is a gender equality designer. She worked as a project manager for the implementation of gender budgeting at the Ministry of Finance and Economic Affairs in Iceland from 2010 to 2016. Katrín has a master's degree in business administration and gender studies. She was the first spokeswoman for the Feminist Association of Iceland from 2003 to 2007. She has worked as an independent consultant regarding gender equality. She's written a weekly column on gender equality for a business newspaper, and she has taught at the University of Iceland Gender Studies program. Previously, Katrín worked as a project manager for a software company in Iceland. She moved recently to Dallas, Texas, just 2 weeks ago. Also with us is Bryndis Isfold, an experienced campaign manager and creator of progressive gender equality policy. She served as deputy city council member in the capital city of Reykjavik, Iceland, where she led the team that wrote the progressive human rights agenda. She served as a policy advisor to the national government and was an effective advocate for gender equality. She's been campaign manager for many campaigns, including leading the campaign for Iceland to join the European Union, the campaign for president of the Social Democratic Party, and since moving to New York City, worked on de Blasio's successful campaign for mayor. In New York, she's earned a master's degree in election and campaign management from Fordham University. Bryndis and Kata, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good. That's Bryndis. Is Kata with us yet? I think they're trying to get her on the line.
All right.
All right. So, Bryndis, you and I will start. And I'm very excited to have you on the program today. And you just have so much experience helping with gender equality, which we know helps women, men, and children. But let's start with a very fundamental question. What is gender equality and why does it matter?
Well, I think Hillary did say it the best 20 years ago in Beijing when she said gender equality is a woman's rights, human rights. And I think that's sort of the core of it. And I think everyone understands it if we start talking about it as human rights. It matters to us in everyday life. It's something that we see in our culture. We have discrimination in so many places, but I think first and foremost, we in our sort of discussion in the political arena, we talk about gender pay gap, which is the where women are paid less for the same job as men do. So many things. It sort of touches us on so many levels. So I think gender equality is one of the biggest challenges we face. And I'm hoping it's one of the sort of big topics that we're going to be talking about in the next few months, because I hear a lot of talk about gender equality when I'm listening to the presidential candidates, especially on the Democratic side. So it's very hard to have one phrase, but I think in general, gender equality is our basic human right.
Fantastic. And I'm told that Kata is now on the line. Kata, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
Well, hi. Welcome to All Together Now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We're just beginning the conversation, and I want to turn it to you now. How do you see, what is gender equality, and why does it matter?
Okay, I think gender equality means that you have both legal equality between women and men, but also that women and men have equal opportunities in life. And that means that we shouldn't mold people into different gender roles based on their sex. And that matters because we should all have the opportunity to be what we want to be, regardless of gender, and not to be defined to particular roles just because of our sex or gender.
Very well put. And we know now with the World Economic Forum has a gender equality index, and I think it's now, since they've done it for the past 7 years, Iceland has come in number one in the world for gender equality. What is it that makes Iceland number one in the world?
Well, I think it's many things, that a combination of many things. I think it, first and foremost, I think our biggest jump in terms of gender equality was when the Women's Party was established in the 80s. A lot of brave women were advocating for women's rights, radical rights they found at that period of time. But I think sort of the groundwork was laid out there. And I think that one of the main things that changed sort of the way that gender equality has developed in Iceland and the opportunities women have there is through, for example, a lot of available pre-K spots. The cities and the municipalities have realized that if you want to make men and women equal in the job market, which is one of the essential places where they need to be equal, not to forget the homes, but you need to provide affordable childcare and after-school programs. And this has been one of the main policy changes and focus on from the political side. And I think that has sort of put in place a system that works for both men and women, just to name one particular thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's
I
a critical
that.
One.
And also, what scores us very high on the list for the World Economic Forum is also political participation of women.
Mm-hmm.
For example, because we have the first democratically elected female president in the world.
I think let's talk about that for a minute, because most people are not aware that it was Iceland that is the first country to democratically elect a woman as president of your country. And that was when, 1990? 1980.
Yeah,
in living memory.
Yeah, and it meant that we are brought up with a very strong female role in politics, and it changes sort of the assumption who can be in politics. And I think it all comes down to political will. I think when you have political will, you can move mountains. But I have to add that we have always had a rather active feminist advocacy in the country, and they have been very progressive in terms of reaching the mainstream media. And I think that's one of the essential things, because if you want to change gender equality, you want to increase women's rights, you have to change hearts and minds. It is a big informational campaign in itself. So in order to do that, you really have to press the mainstream media to talk about it and to address problems that maybe they don't talk about in their daily news hours, but there are so many things that are so unjust And I see that it is more and more being talked about in terms of politics and in the media today. But still, I think that was one of the key things that changed the hearts and minds of the people, which made it more acceptable to go to change policies within the political system and use progressive means to reach gender equality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, certainly the media is vital. You know, I really noticed it this past week. The Washington Post did front page story on feminism in the United States, and I was reading it, and I was so startled because it's so rare for us to have that kind of a public conversation, to have that put on the front page of a major newspaper. But that is so central to having the issue put on the table and have people talking about it and getting people some information. So I think you're absolutely right. The, you know, the media is a vital component here. And mm-hmm. Brindis, you mentioned the Women's Party. So tell us a little bit. This is the women formed their own political party and ran candidates, or how did that work?
Yes, they did. They ran candidates for the parliament in Iceland and also in some of the municipalities in the 80s. And what happened is that they became rather popular. They got elected few members of parliament, but they cast a light on the other political parties, which some of them didn't have any women among them, or no women leaders, or no issues regarding women. And all of a sudden, the voters, half of them, of course, women, who also tend to vote more in Iceland as in the U.S., realized that the other political parties didn't have an agenda for them. They felt, you know, left out. And that's one of the biggest roles that the Women's Party had, was to press the other parties to react in a more gender equality manner. And they made enormous changes. Also, one of the leaders of the city for years became the mayor from the Women's Party. And she changed the thing that I was just talking about earlier, about her. One of her main goals was to add affordable childcare, preschools from, and now it's actually, you can get preschool for your child at 2 years old for much less money than you pay in the U.S. And that made, it did the changes, and also the after-school program. It made the changes so that women became more equal in the job market. It made sense in terms of family values as well, but it changed the whole structure of society and how women, or the opportunity that women had. So major effect. And it did mostly, like I said before, it pressed the other parties to look within themselves and ask themselves, so what's our agenda for women? You know, how are we going to get women to vote for us? And therefore they started to invite more women to become leaders of their parties and so on.
That's great. And it's just so critical having that, you know, the preschool, the pre-kindergarten programs, the after-school programs frees women up to be able to be working at all, and also to be working full-time in a way and not so worried all the time about taking care of the children, what happens after school. So that's a really helpful insight into one major change that we could make here that could have a big impact in a broader arena. Mm-hmm. And Kata, you mentioned, you know, what, when we asked what makes Iceland number one in gender equality, you mentioned political participation. Do you think having the Women's Party was a piece that inspired people, or how did you get more women to participate politically so that all these other changes could be made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely had a big impact, like Brindis was saying. And just to give you an example, the percentage of women in parliament went from 5% to 15% when the women's list ran in the first year. And now the number of women in parliament is 44% in Iceland, which is so we've been like going uphill gradually. We still haven't had women in majority or 50%, so we still have some milestones to reach. After the crash, we also had a major breakthrough, which was the first female prime minister. So we have a different mm-hmm. political system than here, so the prime minister is has actually more power than the president. So that was also a big breakthrough for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, just so our listeners can compare, and you probably know this, but you've got 44% of women in your parliament, which is equivalent to our Congress here. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., we have about 20% women in Congress. So you have more mm-hmm. than twice as much representation in parliament.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just a big thing. If we can get more women in there who are aware of what the conditions are for women in the country and families, they'll do more on those policies. We just have to, we're still working towards getting a critical mass here in our own Congress and mayors
even. Yeah, I mean,
we
see that women bring different issues to the table. For example, more emphasis on childcare and so forth that Bryndis was mentioning before. But I also want to mention that it's not enough to have women in parliament. They have to be dedicated to gender equality as well.
Right. Which kind of women and what are they doing?
Sorry,
exactly. So I want to talk now about gender budgeting. And Kata, you worked on gender budgeting for the whole country of Iceland. And I've been saying for quite a while here, we needed to be looking at the budgets, whether they be city budgets or state budgets or our federal budget, look to see where does the money come from and where does it go with a gender lens, because there can be a different impact on women and men that's totally kind of not visible by the way that we're raising and spending money. So I was thrilled to meet you at the International Women's Conference in Iceland in October and to realize there is an actual job working on the gender budget for the whole country. So could you please tell us what is gender budgeting and what did you do in that role for your country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically gender budgeting is a tool to eliminate discrimination and further gender equality. It so happens that our economic well-being is also better with gender equality. So by taking the gender lens to the budget, you can improve both gender equality and the economic well-being, which is a win-win. But Iceland is not, we did not invent gender budgeting. It traces back to 1984, all the way to Australia. They started the first gender budgeting project there. And then it has spread all over the world. We started implementing gender budgeting in 2009, and I was hired as a project manager to oversee the implementation process in Iceland. So what we did, we emphasized that all the ministries would participate. So they've all been working on projects since 2010 to analyze the effects, the gender effects within the budget. And we've looked at both the expenditure side and the revenue side. Because often there's a lot of emphasis just on the expenditure side, but there is also a lot of gender effects for how revenue raising is done. For example, how the tax system is structured and so forth.
Good. And can you give us kind of a specific example when you look at the money coming in and the money being spent in the government? What's an example of something you saw and you went, hey, wait, the way this money is being raised or spent is not fair to women or needs to be adjusted in some way to be more fair?
Mm-hmm.
What's a specific example?
In Iceland, we found that because the status and gender roles are so different for women and men, for example, the job market is quite gender disaggregated, and women still bear the brunt of unpaid household and care work, just like they do here in the States. Because of that, we found that most projects showed different impact on women and men. And we also found that sometimes the way we are using funds doesn't benefit women and men in the same way. And to give you an example, we found, for example, that women have to wait longer for cardiac imaging than men, so they don't have the same access to healthcare. We also found that changes that were made to the unemployment benefits after the bank collapse in Iceland benefited men more than women, and it's simply because men tend to have higher incomes than women. And the list is quite long. For example, agricultural subsidies are paid to men, mostly. And there is a systematic hindrance to changing that so that you can pay both partners who run the farm together. And this impacts women in many different ways, not only because it means that they are not financially independent within their relationship, but also it affects, for example, their pension rights in their old age. So there can be multiple factors that come into play. We also found that the tax system isn't always in the spirit of gender equality. For example, a joint tax system is often not beneficial to gender equality, and it can have incentives for women to stay at home or to do part-time work. So there are many things that we found out and that need to be changed.
That's fascinating. And I know you're newly arrived, just 2 weeks here in the United States, but you're now living in Dallas, if you were to advise a mayor here in this country about seeing how their budget affects women, what information do you think a mayor would get from your review, and how do you think it would help a community here in the United States to have gender budgeting?
Well, I think that the most important thing is to make gender budgeting a part of the decision-making process, which means that every time you're going to be making changes to the budget, that you would review what effects that changes will have. Also, I think it's very important that you train the staff in how to use gender budgeting, because it's best to commit to implementing the process. So, because it's a long-term project that you... gender budgeting is not something that you should do like a one time and then get it over with. It's more something that you should incorporate into your daily operations, because the budget is constantly changing, so you always have some gender effects to examine and look at.
Well, that's exciting. I'd love to bring gender budgeting to every city in America, every state in America, into our federal budget. It just would be awesome to see how we take money in and spend money impact women and men differently, and how can that be made as a tool of equality.
Yeah, I agree with you. It mm-hmm. can make a lot of difference, because most people think that the budget is neutral, because it doesn't say anything about how it affects women and men, that it has the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you start looking into it, you will see quite a lot of different impacts that it has, and there is a lot of improvement that you can make. I think I can state for certain that every country that has done gender budgeting has found out that the budget is not gender neutral, and it doesn't benefit women and men in the same way.
That's great. So you could basically help train a staff of a leader in the United States on how to look at their budget with a gender lens. So you do the training, and they then have a new set of eyes so they can see what is actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
That would be awesome. Brindis, you worked
yes.
in the city capital of Iceland, Reykjavik.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So... Now, what would you say were the most effective changes in the capital city that improved gender equality while you were working there?
Well, there are many things, and it's like in every city, you have different things that you have to look at. We are responsible for education, as here in America, and all kinds of social services. I think that first and foremost, what we did is that we put in place a very clear policy that was quite proactive, which meant that we were trying to foresee what could come up, what kind of problems would come up, and also set in place different kind of project that would react to try to push gender equality, not only react to problems that came up, but push for further gender equality. So I think there are many things that worked well. One of the things that we also needed to have to make this work was political will, and it was essential that we had the mayor with us speaking about it every event he could at the time, and it was a woman, a mayor, it was very important to have the political will behind us. But one of the things that we did, and which is related to gender budgeting, is that we got a complaint that girls were getting, you know, not as good places to play soccer. They had different types of fields that they could play on. And some of them are considered more expensive to play on than others. And by using gender budgeting, we could look at the numbers. We could look at the numbers of when the girls' teams and when the boys' teams, which belong to the city partially through funding, were, you know, how much they were actually renting the fields for the boys and at what hours of the day, because by some tables we could see how much they were valued in terms of if someone else came in and rented them. And we found that the boys were getting better hours and better fields. So by using numbers and gender budgeting, we could correct that. And as it was not, you know, directly responsibility of the city to be in charge of the sports clubs, but we were funding them, we could say to them, because we put in the policy that a third party that we worked with would have to work in the spirit of the human rights agenda of the capital. If they didn't, we would stop the funding. So we could tell them, you have to correct this, otherwise we'll stop your funding. So that's one example of how policy work and political will, and also a system that works that you can actually put in a complaint and ask the city to look into it, how that can work and how we can benefit. And of course, we all agree that girls and boys should have equal opportunity. And it does matter where you're, you know, playing the soccer, if it's a good field or a bad field, or if you're playing at 9 o'clock at the evening or if you're playing at 5. So things, small things like that, but also enforcing sort of perhaps a little, you know, something that some people would find quite radical. We didn't want strip clubs in our city, so we put a stop to the license of how many strip clubs could be in the city. That's one of the progressive actions we did. Addressing domestic violence, for example, working with social services, putting in place plans and programs where the police, social services could work together to make sure that victims of domestic violence would have the best service available when they wanted to get help. So there are many things that we saw once we put a very proactive policy in place, and we had the political will behind us, but also, and very importantly, we had to get the information about the policy. When we put in place a new policy, we needed to have all the information out there, both for the citizens, so they could actually use the policy on their behalf, and also for all the people who work in the city. And the city runs, I think, the second largest, is the second largest employer in the country. So it's a lot of people you need to educate. So I think there's so many things that cities, you can do on the city level, but I think first and foremost is the political will. But the good news is that it has actually paid off very well. People really like to have a good gender equality policy in place. And by educating people, once you put something like that in place, giving out all the information, because you're adding services for your citizens, it's rewarded.
Right. People get happy when they actually get something for paying their taxes. And it sounds like you did an awesome job there in your capital city, and it's things that I'd love to see happening more in cities across this country, too. Kata, now, you define yourself here gender equality designer, and I will say that's a new one for me, and I'd love to know what exactly is a gender equality designer and who would hire you to do work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I started calling myself a gender equality designer after being inspired by two great women. One of them is a close friend of mine, and she's a graphics designer. And she started a project looking into how design has been used to further equality. And then about the same time that she was looking into this, we got a visit from Sweden from a woman named Margareta Winberg, who was at the time, she was the vice prime minister of Sweden. And she gave a speech in Iceland, and she talked about gender equality. And she said, we have never seen a society with gender equality. We don't know what it looks like. But we know that it has to be created. It has to be created just like we make computers and everything else around us. We have to create gender equality. And that's what inspired me to take up the job title, Gender Equality Designer, because it emphasizes that it's something new and it's something that you have to make and you have to design it because you want to create a society that is good for everybody. And that's something that doesn't come by itself, so you have to put in the effort. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of like a positive way of shining a light on that.
That's tremendous. Well, I just hats off to both of you for all that you've done for the women in Iceland and for creating great models for gender equality. I hope we get to draw on your expertise now that the two of you are living in Iceland. We in the United States, of course, want to become number one for gender equality, so maybe you can help us get there. That's all the time we have for this segment. Katrin Anna Gudmundsdottir and Brindis Eisfeld, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for all your great work for gender equality.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Our next guest is Alison Silberberg, the new mayor of Alexandria, Virginia, and author of Visionaries in Our Midst, Ordinary People Who Are Changing Our World. Mayor Silberberg, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be with you.
Yeah, I'm just so excited that you ran for office there and that you won. And you're someone, you were a writer and a lifelong advocate for social justice, you know, not your typical politician. Why did you decide to run for mayor?
Well, many reasons. I've been deeply involved in the community for over 25 years. I've been involved in different forms of public service since moving here. I moved to Alexandria in 1989, and I had previously interned on the Hill while I was in college at American University in the early to mid-'80s. I'd interned for Senator Kennedy, and then when I moved here in 89 to Alexandria, I worked on the Hill for Senator Benson and worked in Anacostia at the height of the crack wars, helping youth realize their potential through film, and served on a commission in the city for 8 years, the Economic Opportunities Commission, and ended up chairing it for 2 or 3 years. And that commission serves as an advocate for the most vulnerable. And my writing is always, my work, it's always focused on social justice issues, and Visionaries in Our Midst is about raising awareness about what's possible and profiles individuals who stepped up and made a difference in their community. And so one thing led to another, and I decided to run for council in early 2012 and won. And I was thrilled. I was really running for council to be one of the top six, Eleanor. And then I got the most votes. I've often said that I must have, I joked that I promised everyone a free trip to Jamaica in January if they voted for me. And anyway, I got the most votes. And
That's your secret.
That's my secret sauce. And then I became the vice mayor, and that's where I was serving for 3 years. And then this past year, in March, I announced that I would run for mayor, and I won, and I'm deeply honored about this, and I'm working very hard for our beloved historic city.
Yeah, well, you live in such a beautiful city there. I've been fortunate enough to go to Alexandria many times for lunches, dinners, walking in the streets. For our listeners who have never had the pleasure of being there, Alexandria, Virginia just has, it's this historic and charming old town section and has a tavern still where George Washington dined.
That's right.
And
it's like Gadsby's Tavern. That's right.
Yes,
a lot
I love
of historic
going in
preservation.
There.
Right. Well, historic. Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that because historic preservation is a core value of our city. We have actually a number of historic districts in the city in addition to Old Town. A lot of people don't know that. I think that I keep trying to find out if it's 6 or 7 total historic districts in the city of Alexandria. And from the west end of Alexandria to Old Town and everything in between, it's a city of great communities, great neighborhoods, and people who are just so committed to our sense of community here. We're very blessed. And I will continue to do all I can to protect our neighborhoods and to listen to the citizenry. I'm known for that, frankly. I've hosted a monthly coffee here since I became the vice mayor, and I will continue that as the new mayor. It was called Council on Your Corner, so now it will be called Mayor on Your Corner. And it's just a monthly coffee that I do. Anyone's welcome to come and share their ideas and concerns. And it's very old-fashioned. It's great.
Well, you know, I don't think it's old-fashioned at all. I actually think it's the key to good governance. And we're born with 2 ears and 1 mouth, but so often people who get into politics kind of forget that. And it's fantastic that you're doing that kind of listening, and I think that's a big part of how you built the level of support you did in your community. You mentioned historic preservation, and for you to become mayor, you actually had to take on the incumbent mayor, who was seen by some as in the pocket of developers and just seemed to be kind of unraveling much of what is so precious about Alexandria. But you took on an incumbent mayor who was well-financed and well-connected, and you won overwhelmingly. For those of us who are there, our listeners who are concerned about social justice and all the issues that you've worked on over your lifetime, but they kind of feel that running for office is beyond them or too complicated or too hard, what would you say to our listeners about how can you take on a well-connected incumbent and win?
Well, that is a fabulous question. Well, let me break this apart a little bit. First of all, I certainly honor the former mayor's longtime service and commitment to the city. It was a three-way race in the spring. It was Bill Yule. He was a four-term mayor. Yule was a four-term mayor and running for his fifth term. And then the former mayor, Kerry Donnelly, he had served 2 terms, and he was running for election, and then myself. And all you can do in life is try. And I know that might sound trite, but it's really true. I speak from the heart. I'm not a lifelong politician. I just am interested in doing what I can for the public good and committed to public service, inspired by the lifelong work of Senator Kennedy, for whom I interned, and many other leaders like Barbara Jordan and others. I do tend to bring just sort of a can-do spirit to the table here at City Hall. I often say to the staff and to my colleagues on the council, and I'm honored to serve with them, is, you know, let's talk about what's possible. Let's look at what is, but let's look at what's possible, and let's talk about how we can make things even better. In terms of historic preservation, I believe it should be a core value of everyone who is elected to office, that that should be a top question for our citizens here. And for those who are listening, Alexandria was founded in 1749, clearly predates the founding of our great country. People, as you mentioned, President George Washington, who was then General George Washington, not only dined here and enjoyed Gadsby's Tavern, where everyone can go and eat and drink today, in fact, try the drink that he loved to drink there, but really the narrow streets, some of them cobbled here, that these great people walked our narrow streets all those centuries ago, and that they dreamed of a better way for our country, and against great odds, you know, the British Empire. And George Mason primarily wrote what is known as the Fairfax Resolves. And the Fairfax Resolves was this document which, you know, they staked their lives as George Mason, George Washington, and many leaders of the city of Alexandria, putting their lives on the line and their fortunes and their just everything on the line so that our nation could have a chance to be formed. And so if they can do that, I think that those who are listening can say, well, you know, it's a matter of stepping up and saying, I have something to offer and I would be honored to serve and here's my vision. And I built a team of all volunteers. It's totally a grassroots campaign. And we got it done and everyone was a volunteer and I never sent out a mailer asking for funding. Funding is an important part, but I never wanted to do that. It's just not my way of doing things. And if people wanted to give, they knew how to give. And if they don't, they have other, there are many ways to give to the campaign, and that's okay. And I just never wanted to pressure anyone at all. It's just not my way to call people and ask for funding. So if someone's listening and they say, well, how can they get involved wherever they live? There is a way. And but I would say first, you have to be involved in the community and you have to know the issues and be interested in people and their needs. I just want to help people. So every day I get to come to work here and help people I don't even know. And I don't need to know them to help them. And that was really, you know, when I interned for Senator Kennedy, I want to mention one more thing about that, because one thing that I noticed as a young intern there was that there was this great sense of mission in his office and in his life. But in that office, everyone felt it. It was palpable. And I thought to myself, I want to have that great sense of mission every day in my life. And I have for many, many years in all of my work, but now I officially get to do something. But everyone can step up. That great quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that anyone can serve. You don't need to have a graduate degree or know Plato, or I'm going to mess up his quote, but it's one of the great quotes that he is famous for. So I hope that's inspiring to others, because we need many more people to step up and be involved in public service in any way, shape, or form, whatever, serving on boards and commissions, volunteering for a nonprofit, and helping a neighbor, coming and speaking before the city council, writing letters to the editor, volunteering on a campaign. It all helps. It's a team effort.
That's so eloquently put. And Senator Kennedy was my senator. I'm originally from Massachusetts and born in Boston and knew him and knew the Kennedy family a little bit. And I've been in that office you're talking about, and he was so inspirational. It's such a loss that he's not there, but I'm so delighted that his tradition of public service kind of lit a spark there in you, and you're carrying on a great tradition of public service. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, actually, my family was, you know, growing up in Texas, that my family was deeply involved in community and dinner table conversation every night was about what was going on in the world and in the country, and whether it was race relations or civil rights movement or Vietnam or war or whatever it was, and you had to be informed or you really couldn't participate in the dinner conversation even as a little kid. So my mom was deeply involved in community, and my father was certainly committed to it, but my mom was deeply involved in it and really instilled in me and my sisters a sense of you know, how we could be involved with the public good. And so my mom was involved with helping someone, a friend, get elected to the city council, and she became the first woman mayor of Dallas, and she's been mentoring me since I was 5. And then Adeline Harrison is 92, and we're still very much, still very close. And my mom helped Ann Richards as a volunteer and then as a campaign office manager for Dallas and North Texas. So it's a, I think that by the time I became an interim Senator Kennedy, I was already very committed, but I became even more inspired. And I certainly think it's a great loss that he's gone, but what an incredible legacy he has left for all of us, and a great legislator. And I love that sense of mission. I'm so glad to hear that you're from that part of the country. I had no idea.
Yeah, and just, you know, he's one of my heroes, and he's just did such amazing work, and I just say a great legislator. And here you are carrying on and doing your great work there in Alexandria. You mentioned about having historic preservation as a core value for you, for anybody who wants to serve there, and that's a conversation that needs to happen in Alexandria. What do people want? But you clearly have a strong commitment to preserving what's precious about this historic part of the world, and yet there has been, and I expect will continue to be, some severe pressure to change and develop and to build. How are you going to deal with the pressure to develop in that precious area?
Well, one of the main themes of my campaign and main themes for me as a former vice mayor and now as mayor is that I believe we should pursue thoughtful, appropriate development that fits in, is to scale, and will complement the existing historic neighborhood, or the complement the existing neighborhood wherever that is in the city, so that we're respecting the existing community architecturally and in terms of size and mass or scale. I think that I'm certainly for having that conversation. There are architects who specialize in building within a historic district. I think that we should be pursuing those conversations more vigorously, and I'm working on that to find these folks and encourage that when we do development that we are encouraging those folks to be chosen. In terms of the material that's chosen for any work as well. So historic preservation is, you know, so many of the buildings have easements or landmarks, historic designations already. But we have to be extremely careful with what, that's why we have a Board of Architectural Review, and we have a whole host of historic foundation organizations that are committed to this. So when we build, we just have to be respectful of that. And with that going forward is a top priority for me, and I've made that very clear to any and all. And I think that we have to continue to pursue that together. We have a remarkable city here. One of the things I said countless times is that all of us are the temporary stewards of this national treasure called Alexandria. So I take this very seriously, and there are many incredible stories of our city that touch the very fabric of our nation's history, whether it's the Revolutionary War or before the Revolutionary War, actually. And the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, and it goes on and on. And it's so exciting to be here. And right now, actually, Mercy Street is on PBS. It follows a PBS series that follows Downton Abbey every Sunday night, and that's getting a lot of attention. and that takes place during the Civil War. It's people come here from all over the world to walk our streets and to enjoy the unique shops here, to dine in, you know, these incredible restaurants here. It's never ending. I just was at a ribbon cutting a second ago for a new restaurant, an Italian place called Hank's Pasta Bar. Very excited about that. There are so many fantastic places to eat and enjoy. And again, we're talking about Old Town, but again, there are other historic districts in the city, and then there are other areas that have wonderful restaurants and shops, from Del Rey to the West End, and in between. So I'm so honored to be the mayor here.
Yes, Alexandria is truly a national treasure. I just get over there as often as I can. And you mentioned historic preservation as a top priority. What are your other priorities as mayor?
Well, one of my top priorities has been, I've been talking about this for over a year, is taking a look at that we should be a national leader in ethics and transparency. And right after the November 3rd election, I put together a small brain trust of legal experts to look at all these issues. And then I put forward a proposal, and a version of that proposal was passed on Saturday. So, and I will continue to work on that as we move forward, looking at other issues. Other issues are, I've already announced in my installation speech, if you will, where I was sworn in, that our tree canopy, we need to go from 33% where we are to the national goal of 40%. And I would also like us, I've been talking about the fact that I would love for us to encourage folks, citizens, to donate a tree, not only for the tree canopy, but to think about donating a cherry blossom. I've asked our staff to look at the possibility of having hundreds of cherry blossom trees along our waterfront, and that they would be donated by the citizenry, so that the citizen, you know, if you have a birthday or an anniversary that or a holiday gift, that I'm sure we could have hundreds of trees planted from the citizenry. And I'm very excited about that initiative of mine, and I'm asking people for their input about that. And just beautification in general is a big core value, and implementing the Alexandria Parks Foundation, which I shepherded through in the last term. Another issue is public safety. I went to this conference for newly elected mayors at Harvard. It's, they call it New Mayor School, but it's officially the conference for newly elected mayors at the Kennedy School of Government. And Mayor Walsh of Boston talked to us, and one of the things he talked about was the importance of having what is known as a next day meeting. And that means that if something, God forbid, happens in the city, a tragic shooting or something, and we have very low crime here, actually, which I intend to keep it low, but in the event that something tragic happens, he said that the next day he has a next day meeting where he brings in stakeholders and the clergy and the chief of police and the city manager, et cetera. And I intend to do that. And I have already instituted that as a new policy, that if, God forbid, something happens, we have a next day meeting. Second, that we have a council clergy. So I've been asking various clergy in the community, as I run into them, and I'll be calling them as well, that we'll have a coffee, a regular coffee, and sit and get to know each other, as well as build bridges of understanding, but also ways that we can work together, especially on behalf of the most vulnerable. And in the event that something tragic happens, all the clergy council will be there together to help each other through this and help the community as a council. I'm very excited about that. That was another suggestion from Mayor Walsh of Boston. So I took so many suggestions from that new mayor school and took copious notes. And we're also looking at ways to build upon our 911 system and improve it even more. And we have a really good rapid response system, but still, if you can do even better, it can save lives, of course.
That's
so these
awesome.
Are some of the initiatives. In addition, I have an arts initiative. I'll be talking more about that. In fact, some of the art from the Torpedo Factory from local artists will be installed soon in my office here at City Hall, where I'm sitting right now, to promote the arts on a daily basis in our lives and to demonstrate my firm and lifelong commitment to the arts and to get everyone focused on it as well.
That's a great roster you've lined up for yourself there, what you can do as mayor. And by the way, Mayor Marty Walsh is a longtime friend of mine. I knew him before he ran for state rep even, which he was before he became mayor. And he's going to be a guest on this show in just a couple of weeks, talking about some of the groundbreaking work that he's been doing in Boston. But he's remarkable. You're remarkable. You're an inspiration. That's all the time we have now. But Mayor Allison Silberberg of Alexandria, Virginia, thank you so much for being with us today, and good luck in being mayor of Alexandria.
Thank you so much. Honored to be with you. Thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now. Oh,